This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Well, this has been a long-running case that potentially could embarrass the Italian and the British government. The man on trial is accused of being the most notorious Eritrean people smuggler, Medani Yedego Mared, but he says he is not that man.
That's the reporter Josephine McKenna reporting from Rome. Full details coming up.
Also, anti-corruption activists focus on corrupt money in London coming from Nigeria. And a leading critic of Rwandan President Paul Kagame has been charged with inciting insurrection by the country's prosecutors.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story, a new trial has started for the man Italian authorities say is one of the most influential people smugglers in North Africa. However, speaking in court for the first time since he was charged a year ago, 29-year-old refugee Medhani Tesfamariam Berhe says he is not the notorious Eritrean people smuggler Medhani Yedego Mered. Italian prosecutors have failed to produce a single witness to testify against the man they say is Mered, but are adamant they have the right person. The new trial coincides with the four-year anniversary of the migrant shipwreck that claimed the lives of 360 Eritreans. Reporter Josephine McKenna spoke with me about the latest developments on this story.
Well, this has been a long-running case that potentially could embarrass the Italian and the British government. The man on trial is accused of being the most notorious Eritrean people smuggler, Medani Yedego Mered, but he says he is not that man. He says he's actually Medani Tesfamariam Berhe, a 29-year-old refugee and former milk hand. He says wrongly arrested in Sudan in 2016 and extradited to Italy with the help of the British Foreign Office and the British National Crime Agency. So this is a case that's been going on for a while. For the first time, we've heard this man speak in court, and he told the court in Sicily, "I am not the man you think I am. This is not my name. This is not my identity. You are prosecuting the wrong man."
Why do authorities think that they do have the right man?
Well, the Italian prosecutors have failed to produce a single witness to testify that this man who has been accused is one of the most influential and powerful people smugglers that we've seen in North Africa. The Italians acted some time ago to arrest this man, and so far we haven't seen anyone from the Italian authorities seeking to back down. The prosecutors have led this investigation from the beginning. They have petitioned to transfer this trial to Palermo in a court which handles very serious criminal offences. But so far, it looks like this case is proceeding, and we'll just have to wait and see.
How is this case really different from other cases?
Well, we've seen isolated cases where Italian authorities have arrested alleged people smugglers, often smugglers or traffickers who have allegedly travelled with migrants as they've crossed the Mediterranean. And when they've arrived in Italy, the others on the boat have pointed to the alleged people smuggler and said, "Hey, this guy was actually not a legitimate migrant. He was actually running this people smuggling operation." Now, that is still an area that's quite opaque because we don't really know for sure whether those accusations are true in many cases, whether or not these people are the real people smugglers or whether they're just victims when they arrive in Italy or they're wrongly accused. Many cases are really quite obscure and difficult to prove. Having said that, we've had migrants who've come to Italy who've said quite clearly the alleged people smuggler who travelled on my boat was a perpetrator of violence, treated us very badly, abused us, forced us on the boats. So we have seen many accusations like that in Italy in the past. But this case in particular could prove to be very damaging to the Italian and the UK authorities.
Also, this new trial is coming on the anniversary of the boat tragedy that occurred 4 years ago, where hundreds of Eritreans lost their lives.
Yes, October the 3rd is the date which is officially known as a day of remembrance for the victims of immigration. And the survivors of the 2013 shipwreck took part in a silent procession in Lampedusa at a monument that is dedicated to the migrants who come to Sicily in search of a better life. Now, people were devastated by this tragedy, and it actually caused a political sensation across Europe when it occurred. People still remember the pain and the loss from that tragedy. Incidentally, the island's new mayor, Toto Martello, has said it's time to unite and avoid the controversies that generate fear, and he wants to promote Lampedusa as a place of integration. It's interesting because just a short time ago, the same mayor sent a letter to one of the news agencies in Italy complaining that the island was about to, what he called, collapse because there were too many migrant arrivals and Lampedusa couldn't cope with it anymore. But this island really has become a symbol of migrants coming across the Mediterranean to Italy, particularly African migrants. This is a time to remember that tragedy that occurred in 2013.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna. She spoke with me from Rome.
Anti-corruption activists are hoping to shine a light on the hundreds of millions of dollars funneled through London every year by organizing tours of properties allegedly bought with suspect money. The latest tour focuses on corrupt money coming from Nigeria. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
The kleptocracy tour is billed as a journey to the dark side of globalization, and the Star Wars analogies do not end there. Anti-corruption campaigner Oliver Bullough was among the tour guides.
Essentially, the Death Star of globalization is right here, and it's London.
Activists say Britain is sucking in corrupt money from across the world. This is the first kleptocracy tour focusing on Nigeria. Also among the tour guides is Matthew Page, a former US State Department Nigeria analyst, now with Transparency International.
The international community, specifically the United Kingdom, the United States, other financial centers, are playing a huge role in facilitating elite corruption in Nigeria through offshore corporate tax havens, lax banking and property laws.
First stop is the capital's wealthy Belgravia district. Tax papers leaked from the Panama-based law firm Mossack Fonseca suggest two multi-million dollar properties are linked to Nigerian Senate President Bukola Saraki. He has denied the allegations. Also among the several tour stops are lavish properties that have been subjected to asset forfeiture proceedings by a court in Houston, Texas. The U.S. Department of Justice is investigating allegations they were received as bribes by Dezani Alison Madueke, the former Nigerian oil minister and OPEC secretary. Nigeria analyst Clementine Wallop says Nigeria's president is following through, though slowly, on pledges to crack down on corruption, which has such a corrosive effect.
It contributes to poverty, contributes to poor education, contributes to terrorism. You have communities where the young men are compelled to or feel driven into the arms of organizations like Boko Haram as a result of the deprivation which results from corruption.
Nigerian Information Minister Lia Mohammed told VOA the West must do more to help repatriate corrupt money.
The government would not relent, you know, in pursuing this, but we also need the cooperation of many of the foreign countries, because sometimes we are hampered by the foreign jurisdictions.
An estimated $100 billion of corrupt money passes through London each year. Activists say fears over the economy following Brexit are stalling government efforts to clamp down on global corruption, an industry with the British capital at its core. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
A suicide bomber killed at least four people today at a court building in the Libyan city of Misrata. More than 30 people were injured. Details of the attack are sketchy, but according to Reuters, the assailants drove up to the court building where at least one of them detonated a suicide bomb while others opened fire with guns. The Islamic State group has claimed responsibility for the attack, but that could not be verified.
Rwandan prosecutors have charged a leading critic of President Paul Kagame with inciting insurrection. Diane Shimriwagara, who has been in detention for nearly 2 weeks, faces 15 years in prison if convicted. Her mother and sisters were also charged yesterday. Riwagara tried to run against Kagame in national elections in August, but according to electoral authorities, she hadn't submitted enough voter signatures to be a candidate. President Kagame, who was re-elected with 99% of the vote, has led the country in its recovery from the 1994 genocide. However, some critics say his government suppresses opposition voices.
Meanwhile, Rwanda's Minister of Finance and Economic Planning told VOA that national unity has been key to the country's recovery from the 1994 genocide. Kluve Gutete is Rwanda's Minister of Finance and Economic Planning. VOA's Adam Phillips interviewed him recently at the Council on Foreign Relations headquarters in New York.
Well, we've been making progress since 1994 when we had a genocide that destroyed even the social and economic infrastructure, destroyed lives. 1 million people were lost. And at that point, of course, the situation was extremely bad. Inflation was at 65%, economy had declined by 50%, and poverty levels were at 78%. So we've been working our way through from that time, rebuilding the infrastructure, rebuilding the institutions, social, economic, putting the institutions in place that were never existent at that point, and also designing our vision from the year 2000, what we call the Vision 2020, a vision that was meant to make sure that our people reach a middle-income level by the year 2020. And that vision, we had to develop a strategy to make sure that we implement it. At the same time, the economic growth has been encouraging. The last 15 years, it was growing between 7 and 8%.
Now, I know you're a public figure, you're used to speaking in sort of abstractions, but what's it like to sort of be faced with a world that's been so devastated and to have some hope that things would get better and to be in a position to make them better?
Having good leadership helps. A leadership that has gone through the struggles to make sure that there has to be unity among the Rwandans.
How do you affect that as a finance minister?
It's not just the job of the finance minister, unity. It's the whole government and the leadership. And once you have unity and you have the same direction, and you have a program that benefits all the people, the poor, the rich, the young people, women, then it works. If the people don't see the benefit, they don't participate.
Okay, let's talk about women, for example. How are they included in the new Rwanda as you describe it?
In parliament, 64% of the parliamentarians are women. Also in the constitution, each decision-making organ of government must have at least 30% women. The whole planning process, up to the budget process, they are the ones who also participate. They are the ones who decide, I need electricity, I need this road, I need this water, I need this and that. So once they take decisions, then it becomes now much easier to look in the same direction of development for everybody.
You know, development is always kind of a delicate issue, you know. I mean, you want to split the difference between what the Rwandan government sees fit and being dictated to by people who give you money. Is this difficult? Is this ambiguous for you?
Initially, it was very difficult because, as the president was saying, the donor community, everyone will say, well, I want my money to go into the school, I want my money to go into water, I want my money to go. We are saying, once we develop the program, we said, please, why don't you fit in the program? Let's talk about it. But once you agree that this is the program, the government, everybody should fit in rather than the government fitting into each of you.
Can you give me an example of where that happened?
It happened for almost all of them. For example, someone says, the only thing I want to build a school in this area, and you are building a school without budgeting for the teachers. How are they going to be paid? How about the needs of the kids in that kind of school? It's the government who knows the priorities, and it's only the government that can connect the entire donor resources together with their own resources. But now we've gone beyond that because even the aid money is no longer very significant because in the budget that we read for this year, 66% of the total resources of the budget were from domestic taxes. And then the rest is borrowed from outside international financial institutions like the World Bank, the Africa Development Bank, and many other financial institutions.
you seem optimistic going forward.
Yes, definitely. And we hope we can do even much better.
That was Kluge Gatete, the Republic of Rwanda's Minister of Finance and Economic Planning. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips recently at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York.
Twenty past the hour, you were listening to African News Tonight on the Voice of America. In the Gambia, a recent conference focused on the illegal migration of young people to Europe. In recent years, thousands of Gambian youths have migrated through Libya to Italy through what they call the back way to Europe. Many have died during the perilous journey, and European governments have worked to cut the flow. In the first half of this year, the number of migrants entering Europe dropped by more than half to just over 100,000 by the end of June. Pandera Mbai reports.
The International Organization for Migration says over 5,400 Gambians have so far entered Italy this year. The migrants are fleeing from economic hardship for what they see as the greener pastures in Europe. Concerned by the high influx of illegal migration, a privately owned FM radio station in the Gambia, Paradise FM, and the Germany-based Radio Deutsche Welle recently organized a conference examining the issue and to raise awareness about the dangers associated with the dangerous journey. Mama Njai is a former permanent secretary at the Ministry of Youth and Sports. He explains what is driving young people to leave the country.
Shattered hopes are what are pushing the young people into this perilous journey. Now, this is why the issue of youth employment cannot be confined to mere rhetorics. There has to be viable strategies that will create jobs for the young people. Viable strategies that will give back that hope to these young people to stay back, to contribute their quota to national development. In the absence of that, we'll continue to go.
In February of this year, the European Union, the International Trade Center, and the Gambia government launched a new initiative to support job creation and entrepreneurship. The Gambia Youth Empowerment Project is supported by the European Union, which is providing over $11 million from its Emergency Trust Fund for Africa. Mamadou Njai says no amount of foreign aid can bring development to Africa unless its leaders change their style of governance.
There has to be, at the level of governance, honesty, transparency, and responsible governance to make sure that whatever funds is earmarked for youth employment creation cannot be diverted to individual pockets, cannot be diverted by any individual who believes that he has the authority to divert funds that we are giving to young people.
The Gambia government has been working with UN agencies to help airlift some of the stranded Gambian migrants in Libya. So far, hundreds of migrants have been repatriated from Libya to the Gambia. Lamin Dabo is an activist and member of the National Youth Council. He says the media's appealing portrayal of European life standards also contributes to illegal migration.
We also have other things that shape our perception, which is the media. What we saw in our Hollywood, what we saw in our traditional movies, what we saw on our television, what we saw on our social media is telling us you have everything in Europe. But in our own neighborhood, what we saw, floods and disasters and others. So media shape our perception also.
Aliou Diallo works with a Gambian non-governmental organization called Startup Gambia. The company is engaged in mentoring and developing Gambian entrepreneurs. Mr. Diallo says in order to stop illegal migration, Gambian youths must have confidence in their country's economic development.
So I think it also boils down into change the mindset of every young Gambian, that knowing that you have to define what success is meant to you, and in the fact that Europe is the land of opportunity, we need to turn Gambia to the land of opportunity. And we can, and it is indeed the land of opportunity. We have seen young people who have gone from having an idea to launching a $3 million business.
The conference brought together stakeholders from various walks of life. Panelists took questions from the attendees. Many youths at the meeting said they hope the new government of President Adama Barrow will help create more job opportunities and offer more training that will discourage them from leaving home. For VOA Africa, this is Pande Rimbai reporting.
Global crime syndicates are behind the illegal trade in ivory, rhino horn, and protected wildlife artifacts. A new report from a London research organization says to stop this trade, investigators need to track the money to bring the heads of the crime groups to justice. More from VOA senior analyst Jeffrey Young.
The illegal trade in wildlife products is a transnational organized crime, and we must not lose sight of that fact. Like drugs, like weapons, it's transnational, it's organized.
Tom Keating with the London-based Royal United Services Institute, RUSI, along with co-author Kathy Heinlein, spent the past 18 months following the money gained by killing elephants, rhinos, and other species in Africa to the shops of East Asia. Their new paper, Follow the Money, says that while prosecuting poachers and seizing wildlife artifacts are important, halting the trade requires tracking financial flows to identify the people at the top of the business.
Anything that moves across border, across thousands of miles between East Africa and Asia, will have a related financial flow. And so looking at the finances can be a very effective way of identifying the kingpins behind this business.
Interpol and the UN Environment Programme have said this wildlife crime, ranging from killing for ivory, rhino horn and animal skins to the taking of rare species for pets, is worth between $7 billion and $23 billion a year. However, the UN Office on Drugs and Crime says it's nearly impossible to quantify the trade because many African countries don't separately tally crimes against wildlife. Because of the substantial cash value of wildlife and their artifacts, the heads of the crime syndicates have well-packed pockets not only to buy the goods, but also to pay off officials to get their goods to Asian markets. Via Skype from Nairobi, Michael Wamithi of the Wildlife Justice Commission.
Someone has to be wealthy enough or organized enough to spend millions of dollars, $5-6 million at a time to organize a big consignment to leave Africa to go to Southeast Asia.
With so much money on the line, the smuggler networks do not want conservationists and others getting in their way. Last month, Wayne Lauder, co-founder of the conservation group PAMS Foundation, was gunned down in Tanzania in what police say was a coordinated attack. Lauder was one of the people responsible for the arrest of Yang Fenlan, the so-called ivory queen accused of running a multi-million dollar ring smuggling ivory. The RUSI report says several African nations, including Tanzania, Kenya, and Uganda, do not use their money laundering laws effectively in the fight against the wildlife trade. The report says that many law enforcement agencies don't go beyond catching poachers and confiscating the artifacts. RUSI's Keating says police should put pressure on low-level participants to reach the money people at the top of the chain.
Use his financial connections to determine who does he work for, who pays his legal bills, who pays his bail and his fine if he's sentenced. So there's much more that finance can do to help tackle this trade.
The RUSI report concludes that wildlife traffickers, like other criminals, depend on the ability to move money and to hide the proceeds of the business. It calls on states to change their money laundering laws to include prosecution for cash gained through wildlife crime. Jeffrey Young, VOA News.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an inside look at Startup Africa, a nonprofit Delaware-based organization that supports youth in building business skills that foster financial independence, create jobs, and grow financial economies. A discussion on Startup Africa on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.